you're not going to really know what to do with me, but you'll figure it out. And so I just want to prepare you that, like, that's how I roll, and you'll figure out how to make sense of who I am. And I think that's how I teach, right? Or how I talk, like, how I was the teacher.
Welcome to Black Educators Matter. This is more than a moment. It's a movement.
Hey, it's Danielle. Welcome to Black Educators Matter. Our goal is to share the stories of 500 Black educators. We will celebrate the impact and achievements, learn from the lessons and challenges, and highlight the important roles that educators play in all of our lives. I'm excited to welcome today's guest to our show. As a do now, please tell us your name, your role in education, and answer the question, why do Black educators matter?
You hit me with the do now.
Okay. You know, I learned from the best, okay? I have learned.
Hey, my name is Tariana Pinkston. I am an instructional leadership coach here in Chicago for a Noble Network of Charter Schools. And what was, you know, I'm not a good student. What was that?
Adults are the worst students, okay? Why do Black educators matter?
Woo, child, that's not a do now question. That's a whole session. At a high level, I would say, for lots of reasons, right? Like, where we're at right now, there's a lot of anti-Blackness. It matters for folks who look like us, folks who don't, that if we're not actually teaching our children and teaching folks about what it means to live in a liberated society, then who does, right?
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your experience in education. So where are you from?
So I'm really from a town called Mount Sterling, Kentucky, which is like, woo, baby, you know, small. That's where I was born and kind of grew up at. And then at some point I moved to Louisville, Kentucky. And that's where I graduated high school from. You know, that's where I go back to. So that's where I consider home. But really, really, I'm from the country.
The first time I've ever heard your accent is when you just said Louisville. That is when I said, okay, I hear an accent. So you went to school in Kentucky for your elementary school experiences?
Yes.
And
yes.
How was that? Was it a diverse community that you grew up in?
No, baby. It was real white. Real, real white. When I went to Louisville, so elementary school was really white. And I kind of went back and forth between Mount Sterling and Louisville throughout elementary school, moved around a lot. And then, and Louisville was much more Black, I would say. But the high school I went to, there were 2,000 kids. And to me, it felt like there were like, it was like half, you know, Black and white. But realistically, it was probably like 30, 70, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Okay. Yeah. Did you have any Black educators while in Mount Sterling or in Louisville? Did you ever have any Black educators?
I did. I had one in middle school, Miss Malone. She was the bomb. She was an English teacher. And she just didn't play no games with nobody. And she was, I guess, the first Black teacher that I had. So that would have been eighth grade was the first time I had a Black teacher. Mm-hmm. And then the next one that I had was in high school, my freshman year. She was my math teacher. I really appreciate her for a lot of reasons. I hated math. My great-grandmother also died that year, and so I was, like, in a weird space. And I wouldn't say I really liked her class that much because I didn't like math, but she was the bomb, and she just always stayed on me, and she pushed me, and she still checks in on me and is proud of me today, like, you know, as an educator. But, like, I always say she was the representation that what I wanted was possible, right? Even though I didn't like math or her class. Let me make sure I say that. I didn't like it. But all the things that people were telling us was possible, but like I couldn't see it, right? And she was like, oh yeah, Black folks do, you know, get jobs and go to college and do the things that you're telling me is possible. So I think she was my only Black teacher in high school.
Oh, wow. I think that's really powerful because it, you know, it's that quote from that Black educator in her TED talk. I think her name is Rita, where she said, kids don't learn from who mm-hmm. they don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy. Math can be such a challenging subject. And just to sit in this and talk about these numbers and understand this foreign language that is math. But to be like, but I could listen to you do it. I can learn this and try to engage with this from you. But if this was anybody else teaching this, nah, I'm straight.
Nah.
Yeah, I'm straight. So what about your college experience? You had your eighth grade as your first black teacher. Then shout out to you getting a double dose with high school, going right into another black teacher, showing you what was possible. What about your college experiences? And did you go into college declared as an educator?
Good question. So, yes, I went into college declared as an educator. I knew in high school that I wanted to be a teacher. I was in this program called Minority Teacher Recruitment. That was really dope. So I went in like, I'm going to be an educator. I really wanted to serve black kids specifically because I was, you know, really smart. And I was in all the AP and honors classes pretty much since I got to high school. And I thought it was something wrong with the fact that everybody that I kind of rolled the bus to school with, I didn't see for most of the day, right? And so they went in my classes. There was probably, by my sophomore, junior year, maybe one or two other ones that, you know, we kind of rocked together. But that was it. And so I didn't have the language for inequity, right? Or that something was happening here. But I knew that the folks I was kicking it with were smart. And I'm like, we ain't different. We might show up a little differently, but we ain't different. And so I knew then that I wanted to be a black teacher. Like, that really mattered to me. I went to a really, really white, wealthy school. I went to Miami of Ohio. You know, they call it J.C. Carew. It was real white. And so, it was interesting. I consciously decided not to go to an HBCU, which is a whole nother, you know, probably rabbit hole. But when I got there, I was an ed major. I think I had four black teachers, professors while I was in college. One was for Black World Studies, one African American literature, one was my freshman year English teacher, and another one for like a seminar in ed that I had. And so I didn't stay an education major. I actually changed and went to social work and then came back. But it was interesting. That was all about money because you had to take these placement tests to like fully go into education, the education major. And I ain't had no money.
Hello, barrier.
So, big bear. I was like, it's 100 and what? Oh, I can't take it then. I can't do it. And so I actually had to have some people, you know, really mentor me kind of later on through my process. Who would be like, no, you need to do this, or here's what we can do so that I could be able to be an ed major. But we lose folks, right? Because we put all these barriers in the way, and I was just trying to show up and, you know, do the work.
So. Man, the barriers. We don't even talk about the financial barriers that exist for black students once they are in school. We know about tuition and books. We know that stuff. But to say, oh, you want to be an education major. All right. So here are some exams that you are going to need. And it's like, wait a minute. I love that you said that you realize when your homies that you talk to, you recognize their brilliance because we all recognize the brilliance in our friends. But then you go to school and they're not in the same classes as you. And you, because code switching is a thing, and because some of us know how to show up in ways that white America accepts as appropriate and others don't, or others choose not to, so our paths are different. So as an educator and as a student who remembered that your friends are smart, but they're not in the smart classes with you, how does a sense of shared identity and connectedness exist between you and other black students? When you are sitting as the educator, do you see the brilliance in all of your students or recognize some sense of connectedness between you and black students? And if so, how can you see that if others don't? Like, what do you see? How do you see that connectedness?
Yeah, that's a really intricate question. This is what I'll say. When I got to college, I showed up differently than I did when I was in high school. I think for lots of reasons, but I went to this school that was so white. This is the thing I learned really quickly. And this is going to sound arrogant, you know, and that's fine. But I'm smart, and I've been smart, right? And so, like, I knew that I was smarter. Like, I'll talk to people like, I'm smarter than most of y'all. Like, I could outwit you under the table, easy. That wasn't the hard part for me, right? Like, it was the part of realizing that I was black, that I'm like, somehow when I got to school, I was ghetto. I'm ghetto? And so like the way that the world saw blackness, the first time I understood that was when I went to a place that was so white and so rich. And I think I've been around a lot of white spaces my whole life, but not rich white spaces, right? And so that intersectionality was just very different. So I was really rebellious because if I'm gonna be black, I'm gonna be black, right? And so like I came into my own in college in a way that like I showed up as my full self. Like I was country and I had an accent and I wore baby fat and Timberland and, you know, I had a scarf on my head sometimes, right? Like I was fully who I was and I had to figure that out. And by the time I left, it was very unapologetic. If you know how I roll now, that's just who I am. Like I'm just, that's me. Like, I don't know, but I tell people, like, when I do sessions, and I've been doing that a lot the last couple of years, I've been telling them, listen, you're not going to really know what to do with me, but you'll figure it out. And so I just want to prepare you that, like, that's how I roll, and you'll figure out how to make sense of who I am. And I think that's how I teach, right, or how I taught, like, how I was as a teacher, is that, don't get me wrong, my first year or two, like, the honors classes or the AP classes that I taught, dope. I loved it, right? Like you get some kids who are invested, but I think I'm really interested in the harder work. And so my last couple of years in the classroom, I didn't teach AP, right? Like I taught the non-honors, non-AP senior English class, which means I got the kids that didn't believe in themselves anymore, had already determined where they were going in life, who said that they weren't smart, and we was rocking, you know, right? Like, because I think that that's where the work is. And so I was drawn to, because, and also those set of kids didn't do a lot of performing, right? Like they were very much like, nah, Miss Pinkston, like I ain't going to college. And nah, Miss Pinkston, this is what it is, or I gotta do this. And so I wanted to make room for them to have an experience that was powerful and that was meaningful because I never thought that it was too late.
Ooh, I got a question for you based off of that. How do you create a space for smart black kids to show up authentically when they are being taught a Eurocentric curriculum and they are being taught that they are less than, but now they realize, they've always realized that they are smart? How can you engage with young adults age 17 and 18? You know, because that is a very different point, you know what I mean, in life. Mm-hmm. So how did you create space for this group of students to be authentically smart and unapologetically smart, even if their grades and their previous educators and the systems that evaluate them never, ever, ever confirmed that smart, authentic identity?
I really do think that the way you show up gives kids permission to show up the same, right? And so, like, this is how I talk to kids, to my mama, you know, you know, to people like, this is me. So somebody might say something, I'd be like, nah, right? Like, because that's who I am. And so I think that when you bring that full self into the classroom, like, I'm not correcting kids, you know, grammar and all that stuff. Like, I just don't think that that's like what I need to be doing when I'm trying to, you know, build a community, right? Or help to affirm kids in their identity. I think it's really about identity affirmation. And so like, I'm the biggest hype woman there is. That's how I am personally. You know, like, sis, you fine. You know, that's how I feel about folks. And I think that like, we don't get affirmed in who we are. If a kid gives an exceptional answer or a critical answer, like I'm going to either publicly or privately recognize that, right? And you got to know what kids need, and you have to know kids very, very well and pay attention, right? Like pay attention to their moods, pay attention to why they was absent and what was happening. Like I think you have to humanize the work. And so I think that's the first start. And then also depending on where you land, you might have to take some risks, right? So when I was in the classroom, even when my last couple of years when I taught black and brown kids, I was able to make some moves with the curriculum. Because by the time you get to senior year, people don't care what you do, right? Like, they're kind of like, well, they passed the SAT year, yep. They did this.
Yep.
And I really tried to help build confidence in kids. And, like, you are smart. You may not have, you know, show up in a certain way, but, like, what you think and how you see the world matters. And I try to give space and voice for them to, whether I agree with it or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lots of times we may not agree, but to give voice and space. And I think of smart as being having the ability to be critical.
Yes.
Right. Like criticality is how I define what it means to be smart in my class. And so I wanted them to critique systems. So, like, I remember my last year, we started out the year just with some poem that I found about, like, the purpose of schooling, right? And so we talked about, like, schooling versus education and really critiquing. I was in a high-performance charter school, like, what systems are in place, and give them a voice to be critical about it. Like, we always try to shut kids up, but, like, no, you're not wrong. You're not wrong, sis.
That's my favorite phrase, like, you're not wrong. Because a lot of times when you have grown up in a yes or no system, right or wrong system, it's hard to articulate a critical thought that is different than the current understanding, because people, no, be quiet, you're wrong. And it's like, no, you're not wrong. We may not go with your suggestion. It may not be feasible. It might not work right now, but I want you to know the way that you've interpreted this problem and created a solution or an idea, I understand your logic.
I understand it, yep.
You know what I mean? And I agree with you. I do think that that is smart. Reflecting on your experiences as an educator, because you are currently an instructional leadership coach, but you were in the classroom. So how long were you in the classroom as a teacher before you became a coach?
7 years, maybe.
Okay.
I think 7. And then I came out and went into school leadership.
Okay. So what has been your most impactful moment as an educator? It can either be a moment from the classroom or as you've been in administration. But what has been like a super impactful moment for you?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this. This is going to be a weird answer, but this is what I really think. So I was in this Hollyhock Fellowship. It's a fellowship at Stanford for teachers. And so I did that back in like 15, 16, I think. It was like a 2-year fellowship. And it was really about equity work and for students of color, you know, students from low-income backgrounds. And it was meant to like help develop teachers so that they stayed longer in the profession. It was so dope, yo. Like, it just completely changed the way that I thought about the work. And I remember, so the moment that I think is most impactful to me happened there. And then I think translated into what I did next. And so Dr. Jeffrey Duncan Andrade, who was a big activist educator out in Oakland, and he started his own school. Anyway, we had this conference and he came in and he was like, I went to one of his sessions, right? And the way he talks about what it meant to think about schooling differently, it wrecked my life. And I don't mean that like in a, I'm dramatic. Like, I mean, the whole room was crying. Like I was disheveled. Like, it took me 2 years to figure out what to do with what he said to me, right? So much so that after the talk was over, I came up to, you know, talk to him. And I told him, I said, listen, I have something to say, but I don't have words for you right now. So when I get it, I'm going to say it. He was like, reach out to me, gave him his contact information. And it took me another year. And then when he came back, I finally was able to like figure out what it was that shook me. And I think that what it was like this understanding that identity affirmation and the way that we affirm identity and the way that we nurture kids cannot be absent from the classroom. It cannot be absent from the work. And I was trying to figure out why I felt disconnected. Like, I was a good teacher. I love kids. Kids love me. I worked hard. But there was always something that was missing. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And that's what it was. And he gave me language to be able to say that in a way that I just hadn't experienced before. And so I think what it did was like, it just dramatically changed my classroom. It changed the way I showed up in front of kids. It allowed me to, I think, actualize as an educator versus just actualize as a human being.
This is just one of many stories, and we want to keep the conversation going.
Follow us on Instagram at blackeducators.matter.
Visit us online at www.blackeducatorsmatter.org.
Help build the movement by joining our Patreon.
Now, let's get back to our Project 500 podcast.
Now that is some meaningful professional development.
Listen, I'm telling you, I mean, just I think the whole room, and it was probably a room of 200 people at this session, cried just the whole time through it, because I'm like, yo, we've gotten this all wrong. We've gotten this all wrong. And he was bold enough to say it and to put it into action. So there's this. Have you ever heard of a haka?
Mm-mm. Tell us.
So he shows this clip, and I've kind of got into these now. But so in New Zealand, their indigenous tribe is called the Maori. And so they're indigenous to the land. And he goes and does a school visit, like, I mean, at this point, it's probably 18 years. And he's going over there doing some consulting work, some coaching work with one of the schools over there. And as out of like reverence or tradition or respect for him as like coming into their space, the kids are in this big assembly and they do this haka, which is, it's like a ritual that they have in their culture. And so it's some like, it's in like their native language, and there's some like, you know, kind of movements. It's not really a full dance, but it's considered like almost like a war cry, like a battle cry. And so he shows this clip of them doing this, like welcoming him in into their space. And it's all these kids, women, I mean, young girls and boys. And I remember thinking, Black kids don't have this. Like, we don't have that connection with our identity and our history, or these rituals that really connect us and deeply root us to the work, right? Like to our ancestors, to who we are. And I remember thinking, what would we be like if we had that, right? Like, what kind of, it was so powerful. And if you should, it's H-A-K-A. So if you like go to YouTube, you can look up some stuff. There's a really good one of some at a wedding, like they do them at weddings. And you're just like, what is just so in tune with who they are and where they come from. And it essentially is a battle cry. And so I just wondered, like, how do we get that, right? Like, how, if we're so disconnected and we were stolen from our lands, right? Like, how do we tap back into that power? Because when you have that power, that there's something that the world can't tell you. When you are that clear in who you are and who you come from, sis, the last thing I'll say on that, because I can get really excited about it, is part of that session that I was in, one of the things he said, and this is when I, one of the many times that I was crying, but he talked about how because we are so disconnected from our schools, just from our heritage and from our ancestors and from the truth, the way that even Black and brown kids approach, you know, math and science is wrong, because we are taught and we internalize that we can't do it. And, you know, it's so hard and all this stuff. And what he said was, he said, math and science is in our DNA. You literally, your ancestors built pyramids. I mean, the way he broke, and I was just, you know, I'm crying, right? Because I'm also a kid who has struggled to make sense of math and has had, you know, a lot of inadequacies around what that has meant for me. But nobody ever broke it down to me like that and told me, like, baby, that's your history. That's in you. You can't, it's already in you. You just got to pull it out, right? And so I think about that lack of knowledge that our folks have that doesn't show up in schools. And how do you do that work? Because I think our kids would be totally different people if they were in schools that were connected in that level.
That identity affirmation is key. And when you were talking, it reminded me of your freshman teacher, your math teacher, mm-hmm. who, even though nobody said it until you went to his PD and he confirmed that that was already in your DNA, that math teacher triggered it in you because you said she reminded you about what is possible. So it's like another reason why Black educators matter. It's like reminders at various points. Whenever we turn around, if you have a meaningful professional development that talks about how we are doing this wrong, if you have a teacher in the classroom that shows you what is possible, if you have another teacher who encourages you, like, you know what I mean? Like, just for what it does to your identity.
Yep.
Whew. So now since we have gotten some of that out the way, let me ask you this. What is the state of education in Black America, and how did we get here?
I mean, it's bad. It's bad. We know it's bad. The state of education is bad.
And this is, we are recording this in August during COVID, where Chicago has announced that they are going to go fully remote for the first semester. So I'm not sure when this episode will air, but that is what our current reality is.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, it was bad before before any of this even happened, right? And it's so hard now because, right, like, the right move is for us to be remote because, you know, the safety of our families, of us, of the Black family, like, that really matters. But the obstacles you got to go through and the politics you got to go through to even get to that decision are, you know, representative of why our system is so broken. But I would say, I think how we got here, just where things are, where everything we talk about with Black kids is underachievement, the opportunity gap, and, you know, all this thing, it's always about how Black kids are failing. I think we got here, honestly, once we integrated the schools. And so my research for my master's was a lot about a school-to-prison pipeline, you know, really understanding what culturally relevant literacy is and how do you build schools for Black kids to be successful. And I think what the research would tell you is that once we integrated schools, you lost Black teachers, right? Like, Black folks used to educate their own. And because they used to educate their own, that education was different. And so while everybody is like, yes, let's be integrated and like pro-integration, I think it is the start. I am confident it is the start of our downfall. Because, you know, Carter G. Woodson would say, like, when you're educated at the hands of your oppressor, right, like, you have no choice. Like, because we're conditioned to believe anti-Blackness. That's what we're conditioned to believe. And so once you take out the Black educator, that not only impacts Black kids, but that impacts all kids, because that notion of anti-Blackness continues to be reinforced. And it's even more harmful for us because we're taught as Black students that who we are is not right, right? It's not acceptable. And so I think that's how we got here. And this push to get more Black folks in education has got to be what we got to do, because if we're not educating folks like us and folks who ain't like us, that's why, you know, somebody, I'm telling you, those police officers who have killed Black men and Black women and Black trans folks, you know, on tape in the street, they didn't have very many Black teachers. That's a fact.
That's a fact.
That's a fact.
That's a fact. Whew.
That's a whole word, right?
That's an entire word. I had an interview with Mr. Cheney. In his episode, he talked about how he was leaving a store and was surrounded by police officers because they said he looked like a suspect. And as the police were circling him, he still had on his lanyard from school. He was at a store. One of the cops was like, he's a teacher. He works at the school. If that cop, who also worked at the school, I mean, that's another topic.
It's another one.
But if he did not recognize him in that moment, who knows what would have happened?
Yeah.
When we talk about how you have grown over your career, because now I want to get to what you talked about, which was attracting and retaining Black educators. Shout out to that program that you were in high school that, you know, kind of shaped you and kind of brought you to the field. But when we look at the current field, and you work in the field, so you already know what the reality is in terms of Black educators and even Black male educators. So what does the research say? Approximately 80% of educators are?
White women.
White women. So right now in America, education is being taught to all of our kids. 80% of the people teaching it are white women.
Karens.
You know, I'm going to ask you this, because there are some Karens in the world, but have you met any white educators in your experiences, especially as you were in that really powerful professional development? Have you met any white educators who are dedicated to learning about anti-Blackness and anti-racism?
A lot of them. Not just in that program. I have some that I've served along. I have some on the team I'm on now. There are some people out here who are doing the work, who are really, really doing the work. And I've also had white teachers or professors who are really doing the work and use their power and their privilege to be able to open doors and provide access and stand alongside me as some folks. So, I mean, now don't get me wrong, there are a lot of Karens. And I think that context is really important, but there are also a lot of Karens even who are doing the work to unlearn what it means to be a Karen.
Come on, Karen.
So I don't think that...
You ain't got to say Karen.
Right? And so I think that, like, both exist, and I think that they both matter. Like, it matters that we know who the Karens are, but it also matters that you know Karen can change.
Karen, you have to recognize that you can change.
She got to know. And I always tell folks, if you're not doing the work, you can become a Karen at any moment. Racism, it happens all the time, right? And so every decision that you make either takes you, you know, you're making it or you're not. And so one moment you can be out here doing all the work to teach black kids, and the next moment you could be in the grocery store and a black girl has pissed you off, and that's like changed, you know, like your response. And so I don't think that it's so black and white. I think it's a lot of gray, and that's why it's so hard. But so 80% of the force is white women. I mean, when we think about our black male educators, they're, oof, we ain't got but a handful of them. And then the ones we have, we don't treat them well. Right? We don't treat them well. We don't know what to do with them. And so I've been thinking a lot about how our approach to black men and education, and I think it's at every level, superintendent, principal, teacher, custodian, right? Like disciplinarian, we have a deficit mindset towards them. So the way that we respond to them is always in the negative or about where their gaps are. It's deficit-based thinking. And so you can't expect black men to show up into the work when they're constantly, even if they're working really hard or being told that there's something wrong with how they show up.
It's the same thing that happened when they were in school. Now they just grown.
And so why would they want to come back to a school that's like that, right? Like that experience just continues. So I think that honestly, and this is probably really broad and general, but I think that you have to have more black folks in leadership. And that can be CEOs, whatever they're called, superintendents, you know, principals, whatever. You have to get more people who are in charge because you then attract the talent, right? So I always tell folks, because we have really competitive hiring practices. And so, and I can hire, like I can tell you, like, this person is there, this person is not. They got it or they don't. It's like natural to who I am, right? But if it's going to be a teacher of color, who's like, if we kind of compete against schools, right? So they may look at my school or their school, you know, other schools. Within our network.
Yes.
I'm going to get them, right? Like, if it comes between me and you, I'm going to get them. That's what I always say. That's because I am a black leader. And so black folks want to work for black leaders. There's a connectedness there, right? Like, we don't want to, the work is already hard enough for us to go in and feel isolated. So if I'm a black teacher and I have a black principal or a black instructional coach or, you know, some, I can look at a team that looks like me, that's more attractive to me. And so I think when you have people who are leading the work, you know, that's why you send us, that's why we need to go to the hiring fairs and the recruitment stuff, right? Because you want to see somebody who represents your values, your beliefs, you know, your identity. So I think once you do that, you can get more folks into it because there is a connectedness that's there.
Mm-hmm.
And as black folks, we don't want to go. We already operate in a lot of white spaces as it is. But if I see, same thing with the teacher, right? Like if I see you, sis, okay, I know me and you can do it together versus me out here on the island having to deal with this on my own. Because teaching in itself is incredibly hard work.
It is incredibly hard work and heart work. As an instructional coach, what would you say, what advice do you have for first-year educators, especially first-year educators who had to deal with the COVID? I had a guest come on, and this was her first year, and she said that she is in mourning. Like you said that you knew since you were a student that you wanted to be a teacher. She's been waiting all this time to go and start her career, and then this happened. So as we think about the barriers that keep black educators out of the classroom, we think about some of the challenges that move them away from the classroom and away from education. What advice do you have for first year educators?
So this is going to be advice that, you know, that's a good question. So it's two things. The first one is learn your craft. Right? Like learn what it means to be a great teacher. And that takes hard work. It takes time. It takes relationships. It takes patience, right? Learn your craft of how you connect with kids, how you help them understand the material. You're trying to teach them, learn what it means to be relevant, you know, for kids, and what it means to be responsive. Like, learn those things and study it just like you would if you was going to medical school. Or, you know, like, it's a craft, and it doesn't just happen. And so you got to be patient with the process, and you can't give up. Learn your craft, because the best thing you could do is be an excellent teacher, period. It's better than being, you know, a principal or a leader or even a superintendent. It is undervalued, and it is the most important job that you can have. And I say that now. It's like, I'm not in the classroom, and there are lots of times where I'm like, how could I still, if I could teach a class, like, if I could, you know, like, and who gonna let me come in Monday, Wednesday, Friday and do this class, right? Who gonna let me do it? It is the most important job that you can have, period. And it's hard, and you need to learn how to be excellent at it. I mean, excellence looks different in various spaces, but, like, what that means for you, figure out how to do that and do that well. And I think that, right, like, COVID has got the world in mourning, right? Like, and I think she's right. Like, you've waited your whole life for this moment, and so we're mourning. But I think that once you grieve, you go through all the stages, right? And then once you get through that, like, we got to do something. Because here's the thing, the world will never look the same, ever. It just won't. And so we can cry, and I think you should cry. I think you fall out on the floor and you roll around, because that's how I've been, right? Like, I had a child during COVID, right? And so, like, what the loss is for me and for other folks, like, it's huge. And also, it is a time for us to create. I think that my advice would be, if you're just now starting out, you actually have an opportunity to bring something fresh into the world right now. You have an opportunity to think about things that people don't know. When you was teaching last year, people would have all the answers. This is how you do this. This is how you do that. You have the opportunity to create and do something fresh in a system that really needs you to be fresh and original. And so once you get over the mourning, then you stand up and you say, okay, cool, I'm going to try this and we're going to rock with it. Because kids need somebody who's willing to try, because everybody is just stuck. Yep. Right, we're just like, ooh, what do we do? What do we do? It's COVID. Everything is so bad. It is. And schooling and our society will never look the same. And so what do we do now? And I think that Black folks especially, but we don't get a lot of opportunities to create and to put things into the world, right? And this is the time to be able to do it. And so I think it's like, how do you tap into thinking about what are the experiences you had that were powerful? How do you replicate that? What have you learned during this, like, online distance learning? How do you connect with people when you're not there, right? Like, what were your experiences that were powerful for learning for you? And how do you replicate that and give it to kids? And you're going to fail, and that's okay. But you keep at it, because kids need you to keep at it.
That's some fantastic advice. Like, super fantastic advice. And it made me think about a question that I know I got to ask. And it's a perfect full circle moment question. When we're talking about kids needing somebody to be able to try and new and creating new, what's going to happen to this new math? We tried something new. What is going to happen to this new math after COVID? Like, are the kids going to come back with the old math? What is going to happen with this new math? Do you have any idea?
Girl, I don't have no idea. I don't even know. That's the one question I can't answer.
With that. See, we need to get back with your high school teacher. She will have an answer for us. As we wrap up, are there any Black educators that you would like to thank? So from your childhood days, your college days, your teaching days, your instructional days, going to PDs, just engaging with educators. Are there any Black educators that went out of their way to, like, pour into you, encourage you? Could be your peers, or could be someone when you were a student. But any Black teachers that you want to thank?
There's probably several. I would say who comes top of mind, maybe there are two right now, I would say. One of them is Dr. Cheryl Johnson. And she was my African-American literature professor when I was in college. And I did my undergraduate research with her. And she really taught me how to write at a high level, how to do research, right? Like, taught me so much, I think, about Black literature. And she always told me, you know, Tarianna, you're going to get your PhD. And I'm like, girl, I ain't get no PhD. I'm barely about to get this bachelor's degree. And now, every time that I, you know, now that I got a master's degree, when I go back and get my PhD, I always tell her, like, I'm going to do it. And she told me I was going to do it way before I could even have the vision to see that I needed to do it. And so I think that that's dope for you to have a teacher that has enough foresight, who has enough belief, who has enough criticality of your work. Because, you know, I told you I was smart, right? And so I thought I was pretty decent. And she let me know when I wasn't. Like, nah, you got to rewrite. This isn't good.
Come on, feedback.
Made a huge impact on me, probably short amount of time. And then I would say I have maybe a couple of managers, Tamika, Ayana, Jennifer, who were all like school leaders, you know, in one way or another, people who managed me and ran schools that I served in, who were all Black educators, who did the work, right? Like, who pushed me, who taught me, even if it was in non-traditional ways, who continued to make, I think most importantly, they made space for me. And that has meant everything to my development. When you can go into a space and somebody says and affirms who you are, sis, we want you here. You ain't got to show up any differently. You matter as an educator. You matter as a leader. Our kids, our school, we need you. And I think if we can make room for folks, that's how you get them to stay.
That's how you get them to stay. And that's how you get them to pour their greatness into future generations to encourage other people to come. All of that.
So you said it all eloquent. That was good.
You know, I was just building off of you. You know what I'm saying? You gave me everything I needed. You know what I mean? So thank you so much for like coming to the show and sharing your experiences, especially after having your baby. So congratulations on the birth of your baby boy, your son. Is he asleep right now? Is he woke?
Girl, I don't know what to do. My mama got him.
Shout out to the mamas. Thank you. Thank you, mom. Thank you, mom. But for real, Ms. Pinkston, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing your experiences, everything that you've done. It was, it is, and it always will be worth it. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Black Educators Matter.
Are you ready to share your story? Visit us online at www.blackeducatorsmatter.org to sign up.
Remember, make excellence equitable and thank a Black teacher today.